Welcome, friends, to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific? I'm the former military officer, Ray Powell, in California and out in New York. He is the former diplomat, Jim Caruso. Hello, Jim.
Morning. How are you today, Ray?
Great. And I know for a fact that it is not morning there. It's only morning here. But Jim, today's guest is someone who has literally wrote the book on the South China Sea. I'm talking, of course, about Greg Poling, your associate there at CSIS, where he runs the Southeast Asia program. And he's well known for his role in building out the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative. The aforementioned book is called On Dangerous Ground, America's Century in the South China Sea, and is an absolute must-read for anyone who wants to understand the context and the origins of this rapidly increasing tensions in the South China Sea. Greg, welcome to the program.
Hey, Ray, thanks for having me. I hope you don't mind. I'm neither a former military officer nor am I diplomatic.
Yes, but you do have an impressive beard, sir.
I got one thing going.
So, Greg, things have really heated up over the last 18 months in the South China Sea, and I don't think anybody had Sabina Shoal as the place to watch on their 2024 bingo cards. So why should we care about the South China Sea's newest flashpoint?
Well, bottom line is we care about the South China Sea for the same reason we've always cared about the South China Sea. One, the U.S. has an alliance commitment to the Philippines, which is the one out there getting rammed and kicked around. And two, the U.S. cares about freedom of the seas, has since the earliest days of the Republic. So whether it's island building in 2014, seizure of Scarborough Shoal in 2012, or Sabina today, U.S. interests haven't changed. All that's changing is China's behavior.
I guess the question really is, how do we get here? And this has been going on for years. China builds, promises they're not building, expand, say it's the other guy's fault. Just you wrote a whole book about this, Greg, but if you can, in 2 minutes, tell us what's in your book and why we're here.
Yeah, so look, China cares about the South China Sea because the PRC has told itself a fairy tale that these rocks and islands were China since time immemorial. Which was fine. That was a footnote for us and the rest of the region, as long as there weren't actually Chinese ships down there. What's changed is kind of two things over the last 30 years. One, that China modernized its military, built the world's largest coast guard, the world's largest surface navy, the world's largest missile force, and then built the artificial islands in the South China Sea, which forward deploys all of them. So now there's Chinese ships 24 hours a day in all of these places that rightfully belong to the Philippines, Malaysia, Vietnam, Indonesia. That's made them stand, sit up and take notice. And the second and related thing is that China changed its maritime claims. By the early 1990s, China went from claiming rocks and islands to claiming all the waters, seabed, and airspace within the so-called nine-dash line. It's claimed the South China Sea in contravention of international law. So now suddenly you've got, China upended the regional military status quo and decided that it was going to violate one of the core principles of international law.
So you mentioned the nine-dash line, which some now refer to, of course, as the 10-dash line, since their most recent map drew another line around Taiwan. But where did the nine-dash line come from? Why do we even talk about a nine-dash line, and what does it mean?
Yeah, so the origin of the line goes all the way back to the early days of the Republic of China. 1929, Chiang Kai-shek's government sets up this boundary commission that's supposed to go look through all the treaties and maps and figure out where the borders of this new thing called the Republic of China is. And one component of that was looking at China's maritime claims. That commission led in 1935 to the release of a list of names of islands that China claimed in the South China Sea. Well, I shouldn't even say they claimed. Whether or not they claimed it was it was ambiguous. But all they really did was take the British sailing charts that existed and they translated all those names into Chinese. That's why most of the spratlys and parasails in Chinese are named after British ships that saw them or shipwrecked on them. You'd think if they were China's from time immemorial, there would have been pre-existing Chinese names, but no. Then a single geographer, a guy named Bai Meichu, drew a line around that in a private publication. And after World War II, when the ROC decided to formally annex these things, they used a version of that line, the dashed line. It was quite clear at the time, 1947, when the formal annexation happened, that the ROC was only claiming the islands. It was only decades later that some Kuomintang experts in Taiwan and then the PRC government in mainland China decided that the line should be a national boundary so that they're not just claiming the islands inside of it, but they're claiming all the waters and the airspace too.
So a lot of the reporting makes it sound like they're doing this because of the oil and gas that lies beneath the seabed. You think that's right?
I don't know. Am I allowed to cuss on this podcast? I'll just say no. That's BS. If you took every drop of oil that's known to exist underneath the South China Sea and you dropped it on the PRC tomorrow, it would account for about 2 years of China's daily oil consumption. There's a bit more gas. That is also overstated. But the gas is really only exploitable by whoever the closest state is, right? So a place like Reed Bank, which is in the news a lot, can only be made use of by piping it to the Philippines. The Nam Can San field, which provides 10% of the electricity for Ho Chi Minh City, can only be used by Vietnam and so on. So, you know, does CNOOC, the China National Offshore Oil Corporation, want to tap this stuff and sell it on the open market and make a profit? Of course. And it uses China's claims as an excuse to advance its own bureaucratic interests. But Xi Jinping doesn't care about the oil and gas in the South China Sea. Previous Chinese governments did not come up with these claims because of the oil and gas. It's not about the resources. It's not about the fish. It's not even about the commercial traffic that goes through it. China claims these things for the same reason revisionist powers have claimed strategically insignificant spots of land ever since there have been nation states. Because it's politically useful, and China has told itself a fairy tale that now has political cachet.
So you mentioned that China now has gone from just trying to claim all the features to trying to claim all of the water in some form. Usually the way we hear it is the Nansha Islands and relevant waters and adjacent waters. And although they're kind of cagey about exactly which waters those are. But how do you, if you're China, I mean, when I started looking at the South China Sea as a young Vietnamese linguist in the Air Force back in the 80s, of course, nobody could do anything like that. You couldn't control all the water. I mean, you barely get, you know, none of the countries involved really had a sufficient maritime force to control even the features. But now it almost looks like China maybe can start to talk about controlling all the water. How has China achieved this capability to project its power so far south away from China's shores?
Well, there's two things that happen. So as I said, first step, you build the world's largest navy and the world's largest coast guard and the world's largest fishing militia, which never actually fishes, so that you could hypothetically patrol all these places. And then stage two is you build 7 artificial island bases in the Spratlys from December 2013 until mid-2016. 3 of those have deep water ports, and those allow China to forward deploy dozens of Coast Guard vessels, dozens of Navy vessels, and hundreds of militia in the Spratly Islands 24 hours a day. So they're roughly 600 to 700 miles south of the coast of China. In most cases, they are forward deployed. Their, you know, home ports are closer to these places claimed by the Philippines and Vietnam than Vietnamese and Filipino Coast Guard and Navy bases are, which gives China a huge advantage when it comes to readiness and the ability to sustain presence in these places. The one other thing that's really key about the islands is that it gave China censored dominance. So China, courtesy of the SIGINT, ELINT, the radars, the line of sight communications, all of it redundant that they built on the islands, means that China, uniquely in Southeast Asia or in the South China Sea, sees everything that moves on or above those waters. Far better than we can in the U.S., for instance. And so it's able to respond much more quickly and effectively than any other state can.
Okay, so now we have Sabino Shoal, which many of us never heard of before, as a new must-have for China. So two questions. Where is it? Why is China so caring about it now?
Sabina Shoal is a random reef among hundreds of random reefs in the Spratly Islands. This one happens to be about 60 nautical miles off the coast of the Philippines, of Palawan, well within the Philippine Exclusive Economic Zone. Both sides kind of sleepwalked into this current round of tensions. The if we go back to 2021, the Philippines started making a lot of noise and patrols around a handful of reefs in which the Chinese maritime militia was gathering, places like Whitsun Reef, Iroquois Reef. And as the Philippines and Vietnam drove them away from Whitsun Reef, some of these militia vessels started anchoring at Sabina more and more often. So you'd see dozens of them at a time at Sabina. And that got the Philippine Coast Guard paying more attention, patrolling more often at Sabina than they otherwise would have. In combination with that, you get a series of, well, you get one news report, and then a lot of kind of whisper campaigns at the beginning of last year about surreptitious Chinese land reclamation at new reefs, which, for the record, I don't think is happening. There's no evidence of it anyway. But those two things combined got the Philippines spun up that China not only was anchoring at Sabina, but might be planning to build a new island base at Sabina. As a result, in April, the Philippines deploys its largest Coast Guard ship, the BRP Teresa Magbanua, which drops anchor and has been there ever since. At this point, the Philippines has studied the shoal. Pretty clear they know that there's probably not island building going on, but they do see that China had dug up the reef and you know, created a bunch of crushed coral. China, in the meantime, takes the Teresa Magbanua's presence as an excuse to say that the Philippines is planning to permanently occupy the reef. So now they've both created this narrative trap where China can't allow the Philippine ship to stay because it says that the Philippines is going to illegally occupy this reef. The Philippines can't leave because it says that China might take over the reef if they do. None of it makes a lot of sense, but now we're stuck where neither side can clearly back down.
So I want to go backwards just a minute from Sabina and talk about a couple of the flashpoints in the past that have kind of brought us to this point and ask you to comment at least on these two. One being Scarborough Shoal, and I realize it's going to take you back a dozen years, but I think it's important in the context of what we're talking about today. And if you could help us understand its role in the overall story. And then, of course, Second Thomas Shoal, which is what everyone was talking about a year ago and even maybe 6 months ago. But all of a sudden, everything has now moved to Sabina. Can you just walk us through those two circumstances?
Okay. So Scarborough Shoal, to kind of arrange our geography here, you have two big island groups in the South China Sea. The Paracels up in the north, the Spratlys down in the south. Scarborough Shoal is neither of those. Scarborough Shoal is an underwater reef, a couple of rocks that stick above water at high tide, about 120 or so miles off the coast of Luzon, the main Philippine island. Historically, it was treated as part of the U.S. When the U.S. Was the colonial power of the Philippines, and then became part of the Philippines in 1946 upon independence, and was administered by the Philippines uncontested for generations. In 2012, kind of out of the blue, China deployed members of its militia force out of the village of Tonmen in Hainan to go to Scarborough Shoal. They had been, by the way, poaching at Scarborough for about the last 20 years, but in this case, they were very specifically sent to pick a fight. They went to Scarborough, began poaching endangered species, among other things. The Philippines deployed a Navy ship to try to arrest them, as it had done many, many times in the past, in the case of Chinese poachers. And China used that excuse to deploy its law enforcement. And that begins this months-long standoff, where you've got basically Philippine vessels inside the shoal trying to hold on to these Chinese poachers, Chinese vessels ringing it so the Philippines can't get in or out. And then over a series of unclear, murky negotiations, including one here in Northern Virginia between then Assistant Secretary of State Kirk Campbell and Fu Ying, who was at the time the National Assembly Chair in China, the U.S. and the Philippines think they have a deal for both sides to withdraw back to the status quo ante. Chinese forces would pull out, Philippine forces would pull out, and that would be the end of it. The Filipinos pull out, and the Chinese came right back and seized the shoal, and have had a Coast Guard ship present in the lagoon of Scarborough Shoal for the last 12 years and counting, blocking for large portions of that the access of Filipino fishers who have operated there for generations. That is also, not only is that, in many ways, marks the beginning of this cycle of escalation, because it's what prompted the Philippines less than a year later to file its arbitration case against China in the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which it would eventually win. And that was the proximate cause for China's island building. So Scarborough Shoal was in many ways the spark that lit this fire. It also has become a weight, you know, an albatross around the neck of the U.S.-Philippine alliance, because it is widely viewed in the Philippines as a U.S. failure, a failure to act, or at the very least, a failure to recognize China's intentions. So if the more cynical view is that the U.S. didn't think the Philippines was worth standing up for, and the more forgiving view would be that the U.S. got taken for a ride by China. Either way, it didn't reflect very well on the alliance, and that's a legacy that we are still trying to dig out from under today. As for Second Thomas, Second Thomas is another random reef, completely underwater, on the continental shelf and within the exclusive economic zone of the Philippines. It was awarded to the Philippines by the 2016 arbitration. The Philippines has maintained a very small military outpost on it since 99, when it intentionally grounded an old World War II era tank landing ship, the BRP Sierra Madre. And China has, from time to time, tried to starve them out of that outpost. For whatever reason, China finds that outpost particularly symbolically frustrating. In spring 2022, China all of a sudden began doing this more regularly. And by 2023, China was trying to block every Philippine resupply mission to the Sierra Madre, which prompted the Philippines to run these blockades until the end of last year. You had roughly 100 ships on station during some of these resupply runs. One reason China was clearly trying to block them is because the Philippines was bringing in construction materials that whole time, because early in the Marcos administration in 2022, the Philippines had surveyed the ship and discovered that it was in pretty bad shape. So the Philippine goal was to repair the ship. China's goal was to stop that. As of June, it appears that the Philippines had succeeded in repairing the ship. And thus in July, China and the Philippines were able to negotiate what they call a provisional arrangement to allow the normal resupply. Neither side's going to say this publicly, but this was a tactical victory for the Philippines. They achieved their goals, and China did not.
And just going back to the U.S.-Philippine arrangements, 2012, we're still in Iraq and Afghanistan. The idea of picking a fight with China was clearly more than the U.S. could digest. And as you also may remember, we weren't sure that our mutual defense treaty applied to offshore features, right? So apparently this was an open question at the time. So, but at the end of the day, as you know, it put us in bad step with the Philippines. Fast forward to today, we're doing a lot more in the Philippines. We're doing more exercises. We're pre-positioning supplies. We're being more voluble in our defense of the Philippines. And today I was reading with Ray that there's some Filipinos who are saying the U.S. should escort Philippine resupply missions to these places. So where do you think we are in the U.S.-Philippine relationship in regards to how the U.S. helps the Philippines secure their rights?
The alliance is in a better place than it's been in at least the last 50 years. The work that's been done over the last 3 years since the 2021 bilateral strategic dialogue has been remarkable. I mean, we've really not only repaired, but taken this alliance to new heights. A lot of that made possible by the 2019 visit to Manila by then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, in which he publicly for the first time clarified that any attack on Filipino forces anywhere in the South China Sea, disputed or not, would be covered by the treaty. Now, to be clear, internally, within the State Department, this has largely been the position since 1979, and that has been communicated to the Philippines repeatedly. In 1998, then Secretary of Defense Bill Cohen said as much in Manila. He said that the treaty does not only apply to attacks in the Philippines, and that the South China Sea is clearly part of the Western Pacific as defined by the treaty. But Pompeo went out and really kind of, you know, specified that even further. I would push back a little bit. In 2012, we didn't know that the treaty applied to Scarborough because we didn't want to know if the treaty applied to Scarborough. Any archivist or folks in the legal affairs team knew that an unprovoked Chinese attack on Philippine personnel at Scarborough clearly fell within the plain language of the treaty. But treaties all come down to political decisions. We weren't willing to make a political decision in 2012 to back the Philippines. The kind of decision, for instance, we made about the Senkakus with Japan at the exact same time. Now we've changed our minds. We are more politically committed over the course of now 2.5 administrations. I'd say the Obama administration clearly moved in that direction by 2015. Today, the alliance I think everybody agrees on where the lines are in the MDT, at least when it comes to attacks. We're putting, you know, we quintupled foreign military financing to the Philippines this fiscal year. We've got U.S. access, rotational access to 9 Philippine military facilities under the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement. We have our first ever set of bilateral defense guidelines, basically the operating manual for the alliance, which is, you know, it tells you something about the way we previously saw the Philippines and the way we see it today. This is our oldest alliance in Asia, and we never bothered to negotiate a set of bilateral defense guidelines. We've done it 3 times with Japan. So what we're seeing now is the Philippines being treated like a real ally. I would argue for the first time in the history of the alliance. Prior to this, the Philippines was treated as a rental agreement. We gave money and they gave us access. Today, the Philippines gets treated the way the U.S. treats Australia, Japan, or Korea.
So somewhere between the Scarborough Shoal incident and where we are today, we had this interesting 6-year period in which the Philippines elected a much different kind of president, got named Rodrigo Duterte, who had a very different view on the alliance. Why was this important to where we stand now?
You know, Duterte did the exact opposite of what he intended. He was a shock to the system, right? Duterte was elected for purely domestic reasons. He was a populist who had a kind of a law and order message, an anti-elite message, that resonated with folks who constantly complain about the role of Imperial Manila within the Philippines. His foreign policy was not part of that charm. In fact, every public opinion poll throughout his presidency showed that he was wildly out of step with public opinion in the Philippines when it came to his views of kind of his pro-China views, his anti-American views, and his sentiments about ending the alliance. But he was so popular domestically that he was given a lot of rope to pursue that. Even the military and the civilian bureaucracy in the Philippines for the first few years let Duterte do what he wanted to do, which was to try to establish a whole new modus operandi with Beijing. And he, you know, went to his very first trip to abroad was to China in October 2016, where he publicly announced the end of the U.S.-Philippine alliance, although he didn't actually follow through on the details there. Had, I think, 5 more meetings with Xi Jinping over the course of his presidency. Tens of billions of dollars of Chinese aid and investment were supposed to flow. And the implicit deal was that he would quiet down on the South China Sea. And in particular, he wouldn't talk about the Philippines arbitration victory that came 12 days after he came into office. He held up his part of the deal for three and a half years. He did his best to ignore everything that happened in the South China Sea. But China kept getting more and more aggressive, and it didn't deliver the money. So as a result of Duterte trying it the other way, now we have a far, you know, more consolidated, I think, opinion within the Philippines that China is an implacable revisionist power. You know, they look and they say, okay, we gave you Duterte, who bent over backwards to try to appease Beijing, and that wasn't good enough. If Duterte wasn't good enough, nothing the Philippines could do would ever be good enough for Beijing. And so as a result, the only logical choice then is to deepen the alliance with the Americans and build out these new security relationships with folks like Australia, Japan, Canada, France, Germany, etc.
So, you know, now we get into one of my bugbears, which is what the other ASEANs are doing. And specifically, we have countries like Malaysia criticizing the Philippines for inviting so-called foreign entities into the dispute without any reference to what you just described of Duterte trying so hard to make some sort of modus vivendi.
Yeah.
Why is ASEAN so disunited on this, even the countries which have their own disputes with China? And we've asked this a lot of times, by interest in your opinion.
So I think it's no longer useful for us to talk about an ASEAN position on the South China Sea. There never was one, but at least there was the figment of an ASEAN kind of cohesive approach to China from 95 until maybe 2012. That's completely collapsed. You have individual member states, not just the Philippines, but also Vietnam and at times Indonesia, who take a much more, clear-eyed approach to what Beijing is doing and the nature of China's claims. You have states like Cambodia and Laos, who effectively operate as Chinese proxies, at least on this issue, within ASEAN, and make sure there will never be consensus. And then you have all the other states who just don't care. Thailand, Brunei, even though it has its own claims, doesn't want to talk about this. At times, Singapore, and under the current government of Anwar Ibrahim, Malaysia, who just want this issue to go away. And they have the space to do that because they're not on the receiving end of all of this Chinese coercion. Malaysia, in particular, benefits enormously from having the Philippines as a buffer to take all of these Chinese body blows so Malaysia doesn't have to.
One of the states that particularly I know that you and at CSIS and AMTI have taken a special interest in during this time is Vietnam, because Vietnam is actually seems to have taken the opportunity to conduct its own island building campaign. Is that come about? Did Vietnam recognize an opportunity provided by the China's preoccupation with the Philippines, or was this sort of long planned and they just kind of got lucky?
The timing may have been opportunistic, but I mean, Vietnam has always been the most forward-leaning of the Southeast Asian claimants when it comes to physically advancing its claims, physically protecting its claims. Has done far more than the Philippines or anybody else over decades now in defense of its claims. It has been far quieter on the diplomatic front. Vietnam is not comfortable with the kind of public diplomacy that the Philippines engages in, but it's very happy to support the Philippines in doing so, so that the Philippines can take the public lumps for it. Vietnam has the largest number of outposts in the Spratly Islands. Depending on how you count, they occupy 23 to 27 reefs. Some may or may not actually be part of the Spratlys, according to a geographer, and they've got 49 military outposts on those. That's because in 1988, when China started occupying the Spratlys, Vietnam reacted by occupying all of the others that were left to make sure China couldn't get them, while all the rest of Southeast Asia ignored what the PRC was doing. Vietnam then is starting in 2012, after Scarborough, began to slowly build up some of its outposts. Mainly, what it did in that first phase of island building was it added helipads, it deepened ports, it added solar panels, things to make sure that China could not easily blockade those features and that they could be resupplied by both air and sea. All the things that the Philippines should have been doing in that time that would have avoided some of the difficulty that Manila now finds itself in. And now, in this latest burst of island building, which really has kicked into high gear over the last 2 years, we've seen Vietnam quintuple the size of its outposts. Vietnam now has roughly two-thirds as much total land in the Spratlys as China does, which is significant. And what it seems to be using those for mainly is to build out new harbors and potentially at least one airstrip so that it can forward deploy its own Coast Guard, Navy, and aircraft to the Spratlys, just like China has, and patrol the waters it claims. So, I mean, we'll give Vietnam this, and I think it's important. Vietnam has not built anything on these islands that is clearly for offensive purposes, nor does Vietnam have any history of using threats of force and coercion in these disputes. China does. Vietnam's construction seems to be defensive in nature.
So we have this rusting hulk on Second Thomas Shoal that drives China crazy. On the other hand, we have all these features now being militarized by Vietnam. China doesn't seem to react the same way. What's going on?
Yeah, this has become a bit of a Rorschach test. I've seen at least four articles on this. Why does Vietnam get treated differently in the Philippines? I wrote one of them in the last few months. And so I think everybody's got a similar list of things and they put different priorities on it. For me, there's probably three key issues here, and you can decide how you want to weight them. The one that's most important in my mind is Vietnam has shown very clearly for decades that it will accept substantial risk of escalation if it deems something a military necessity. It fought China in 88. It went through a month-long, very dangerous standoff in 2014 over oil and gas drilling. It stood up for its oil and gas drilling again in 2021. China, I think, recognizes that once Vietnam had made the decision to do this island building, no amount of gray zone coercion, driving in their way, using water cannons and dazzlers, none of that was going to work. If you wanted to stop Vietnam, you were going to have to use military force. And Beijing is not prepared to use military force in these disputes. It prefers to use bullying and coercion. It thinks that will eventually work on the Philippines. I think China knows that it won't work on Vietnam. The second issue is the Philippines is a U.S. ally and Vietnam isn't, which in some ways elevates the importance of standing up or of punishing the Philippines, because China views, you know, the Philippines as nothing but a sock puppet for the Americans, and Vietnam doesn't. In a sense, they treat Vietnam with agency, and they don't treat, China does not treat the Philippines with any agency. And that makes it much harder, I think, for China to look for off-ramps and back down on things, to seek compromise in the case of the Philippines. The third one is the black box of the Communist Party relationship. The VCP and the CCP have avenues to de-escalate, to pursue disputes quietly that just don't exist for anybody else, including the Philippines. People overstate that one. There is no love lost between the Vietnamese Communist Party and the Chinese Communist Party, but it does provide a pressure valve at times that other claimants don't have.
One factor you didn't mention was the role of the Philippines publicizing these events, you know, both through embedding reporters or just taking their own pictures and video and releasing it to the public. Something that of course we at the Sea Light have called an assertive transparency campaign. Your mileage may vary. What has been the role of this in one escalating the situation? Clearly, it has not at this point deterred China. And what has been the effect both in the Philippines and on China of this campaign?
So I do not find much evidence for the argument that the Philippine Transparency Initiative in any way caused the current level of tensions between China and the Philippines. Certainly didn't cause Second Thomas Shoal. You go back and you look at the AIS signatures and the satellite imagery, and you see that China began these blockades well before the Philippines started publicizing them. The Philippines publicized this behavior, and it did two things, I think. One, it clearly rallied international support. The Philippines, since President Marcos came into power in July of 2022, the Philippines has almost tripled the number of states publicly endorsing the 2016 arbitration award and supporting Philippine claims. It has developed new defense relationships with half a dozen states, with more on the way. It has clearly garnered the Philippines' international sympathy and diplomatic support, and that is hugely valuable. Second, and we can never... Here's the problem with deterrence. How do you prove deterrence worked? Nothing happened. China hasn't ripped the Sierra Madre off the reef. It hasn't sunk a Philippine boat. It hasn't killed a Philippine sailor. Does part of that derive from the fact that they would have had to do it on live TV, broadcast around the world? I think probably. But yes, it has also perhaps hardened China's position once we were well into this. So I think what you probably saw by, say, the spring of 2024, is that the transparency initiative on the Philippine side probably reached a point of diminishing returns. You had, you know, rallied about as much support as you could. You were putting out information so frequently that I think people were becoming numb to it, including within the Philippines. Public opinion polling suggested that people were just losing interest because they couldn't maintain that level of outrage. And so the Philippine government did the smart thing. They revisited the policy. They began, you know, they shifted around the way that they were going to get this information out. They started letting China be the first mover, and then they responded. And that's continued to today. So, you know, if you look just at Second Thomas, the Transparency Initiative helped rally pressure on China and deter aggression. And then when it was no longer useful, they quietly negotiated a provisional arrangement and have kept quiet since. That seems pretty deft to me.
So what do you think is the next step then for China? It seems in some ways they want to maintain the status quo where Philippines can't perfect their claim to any of these features, but they won't necessarily build on them themselves. And maybe that's the best outcome we can hope for.
So, not something I have a reputation for, but I'm actually a bit of an optimist. On this. AMTI has spent a decade tracking activity in the South China Sea. And every year for that decade, or at least for its first 7 years, I could confidently present metrics by which China had gained more control of the waters, seabed, and airspace every year. I haven't been able to find a metric by which China's gained any more control for 3 years. Since 2021, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia have all pushed back on strategically important oil and gas projects despite CCG harassment, and the Philippines has managed to not only replenish but repair the Sierra Madre despite the largest Chinese blockade effort we've ever seen here. China is strategically flailing. It has, I think, two contradictory demands coming from Beijing. One, you know, stop these resupply missions, stop this oil and gas activity, stop this fishing. But two, you can't use military force because we don't like the escalation risk. And yet, the gray zone stuff isn't working anymore. The Philippines and the other claimants have shown that you can actually stand up to Chinese harassment. And that the only way China is actually going to be able to stop this activity is by using military force. Now, that is extremely dangerous. These, quote, non-lethal activities are only non-lethal in a statistical sense. Eventually, if you keep it up, you will kill somebody. Which is what nearly happened on June 17th at Second Thomas, which is why China got scared and negotiated the provisional arrangement with the Philippines. At Sabina, I don't know. We're in a now quite dangerous position. There's no way that China comes out of this with its overall strategic situation in the South China Sea improved any. It might actually end up killing somebody at Sabina and triggering the MDT, which could put us right into the Cold War that both sides say we're trying to avoid. But look, at the end of the day, I have no solutions to offer here because there are none. Because the only solutions to the South China Sea at the end of the day are a fair and equitable negotiation by China with its neighbors, which is never going to happen under Xi Jinping, unless he has some kind of come to Jesus moment that hasn't been evident for the last 10 years. So all we can hope for in the South China Sea is to tread water, which is unsatisfying, but you know, that's what we do in most thorny geopolitical issues. If anybody's got solutions to cross-strait tensions, North Korea, or peace in the Middle East, I'm open to hearing about them. But we don't, and we don't have solutions to the South China Sea either.
Let's get back to the question of U.S. escorts, because, of course, this has been now, maybe this is not an issue currently at Second Thomas Shoal, but now, of course, it's been introduced as a possibility at Sabina Shoal. What is your view on this idea? Is this something that is whose time has come, or is it something that's too escalatory? How do you feel about these?
Yeah, so, you know, Admiral Paparo, when he was in Manila last week, makes his response in Q&A that he thinks a U.S. joint escort, you know, escort of Philippine resupply missions would be a perfectly reasonable response to Chinese pressure. He didn't say we're going to do it. He didn't say there was a formal offer. He just said that it's reasonable to have it on the table, which is not really a change in U.S. policy. I mean, that's been on the table since at least the spring. It's not that the U.S. hasn't been willing to conduct escorts of resupply missions to Second Thomas. It's that the Philippine government hasn't wanted it, hasn't asked for it, which I think is the smart position. The position of the Philippine government is that it will be in the lead. It will handle these operations as long as it can, as much as possible. I think that's important both to control escalation risk. If it's the Philippines that does it, it's less provocative to Beijing than if it's the U.S. that does it. It helps the Philippines internationally, because if you think, you know, the Malaysians are throwing the Philippines under the bus now, what do you think Anwar would say if it was a U.S. Navy ship escorting it? It would give the perfect excuse to regional leaders who want to believe China's narrative because it would be easier for them. And third, it would undermine Marcos domestically. It would open him up to criticism from his left flank and his right flank now, who argue that he's, you know, just being used by the Americans to position our equipment for Taiwan. So until it is infinitely clear that the Philippines must trigger the MDT, they're not going to. And that makes perfect sense. From the U.S. perspective, our answer is we wait upon your pleasure. If you trigger the MDT, we've already said that we're there. But it's not up to us. It's up to the Philippines whether or not they need to invoke Article 4.
So I'll ask you to prognosticate a little bit about a second Trump administration. Now, that's famously unknowable, but do you have any views how he might look at this?
Now, the Philippine elites that I talk to seem pretty optimistic about either of their options. I mean, they know Harris is a known quantity, given her trip to Palawan. She made a speech on the Teresa Magbanua, which is at Sabina now. Clearly, she's going to continue current policy. Trump, they seem happy with, because they look back at 2019, 2020. They see that it was under the Trump administration that the U.S. for the first time really, like, clarified in plain English the extent of the NDT. And 2020 was the first time the U.S. publicly endorsed the merits of the arbitration award, acknowledging Philippine claims to Second Thomas, among other things. What I tell them is, okay, I agree with you, but be a little careful, because in 4 years in office, Donald Trump never said the word South China Sea in public. Not in a single speech, not in a phone call transcript, nothing. And I would not, you know, put a lot of faith in the idea that you can walk into the Oval Office in the Trump administration and sell him on a narrative focused on international law, much less defensive U.S. alliance commitments. You're going to sell him, it's going to be something about leverage on Xi Jinping or something. But, you know, in as much as we can expect that a second Trump cabinet would include a lot of known quantities, whether they're Pompeo, Hagerty, whatever, then yeah, I think there's reason to think there'd be more continuity than not. Where I would be worried about is if this actually escalated to a crisis, right? If that, you know, if the stereotypical red phone rings and Trump picks it up, is he really going to put American skin in the game for the Philippines? I have no idea. And neither does anybody else.
Well, on that note, I do want to kind of give you a chance to get out on a little bit of a personal note, or personal professional at least. So I was in Hanoi, serving at the embassy there when Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative was really getting going on the whole island building campaign and became a little bit of a household word, at least in the circles I ran in. Tell me about your involvement with that, and what was that like professionally and personally for you to be part of such an interesting part of history?
You and I run in weird circles, Ray. I appreciate it. So it was remarkably fortuitous for me, right? I was working in the Southeast Asia program at CSIS from 2011 onward. I had been running our South China Sea work in that portfolio, including a lot of mapping and some vessel tracking work. And so when the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative was established, AMTR was established here at CSIS in late 2014, Mirarat Pooper came in as the first director, and I was in a position to have a lot of input and write a lot, and along with others, Bonnie Glazer, Zach Cooper, who were also here. And when Mira left 9 months later, I was able to throw my hat in and became the next director. And I've been doing it along with now double hatting as South Asia director ever since. And, you know, we kind of got lucky. It's not like nobody else could have done this. I mean, maybe we were the first to realize how cheap commercial satellite imagery had gotten and bothered to point it at the Spratly Islands. And so we were able to, you know, get a first mover advantage there. But since then, I think CSIS and you know, a lot of the readers and the funders probably all thought AMTI was going to last 2 or 3 years. And the reason it's still around is because we've moved way beyond satellite imagery. I mean, today, I barely even look at the Chinese islands. I don't care what they're building on the islands anymore. I care what they're using them for. And so we spend our time looking at vessel tracking and mapping and different kind of RF detection. And that's what's helped keep the initiative fresh, at least so far. You know, knock on wood, we're coming up on a decade.
Well, it's still great stuff. You're still the really leading the industry, if you will, of open source intelligence and how to use it in an effective and strategic way. So I certainly have appreciated your work over the years, but this has been a great conversation. So what are you working on now, and where can people keep track of you?
So we have a lot of work on the U.S.-Philippine Alliance on both the AMTI and the Southeast Asia hat. That's going to remain a you know, tentpole of our work for the foreseeable future. We're also doing a fair bit of work on U.S.-China competition for influence in Southeast Asia as part of a kind of broader U.S.-China influence in the Global South effort here at CSIS. So look for all of that. And we'll have our annual South China Sea Conference at some point next year. Folks can find it all on CSIS.org and AMTI.CSIS.org.
All right. Well, Greg Poling, it's always great to see you. I'm sure I'll see you around the either here, there, or somewhere else very soon. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks, Jim.
All right. Well, that was a good conversation. I've been working on South China Sea like you have since 2010. It's an evergreen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my own experience goes back to 1986. That was when I joined the Air Force, and they sent me straight to Monterey, California to learn Vietnamese. And of course, we had no diplomatic relations with Vietnam back then. So my interests were much more in the intelligence side of things, but I started, you know, sort of paying a lot of attention to South China Sea. And of course, 2 years after that was the big battle that Greg referred to. When I say big battle, it was essentially a massacre. It was essentially China mowing down about 64 Vietnamese soldiers standing on a, you know, waist deep on a reef in the middle of the Spratly Archipelago. And that was really the last time that gunfire was exchanged. And again, I say exchange, it came from one side and went at the other.
Yeah, it's amazing, though, that there is seemingly a modus vivendi between Vietnam and China right now on the Spratlys.
It really is remarkable to see, and one really has to wonder, you know, strategically, what does China think it's getting out of the way things have been going, right? It is expending all of these resources trying to control a couple of reefs that it probably has no intention of building on, and are very hard to control. You have to, I mean, again, they have dozens and dozens of ships around these things at all times. For what? You know, ultimately, right? Essentially, you know, for symbolic value, I guess. And meanwhile, Vietnam is on this building spree on the other side of the, on the western side of the Spratlys. And it, in some ways, I think this whole thing with the Philippines has distracted Beijing to the point where it has nothing to say or do about it.
As Greg pointed out, he thinks this is all about domestic Chinese politics and showing China being tough and imperial. I'd also argue it's about showing the other countries that we're big, you're small, you have to pay attention to us.
Yeah. Well, I do think there's the old proverb, you kill the chicken to scare the monkey, as I understand it, is a Chinese proverb that in a sense, you know, the Philippines has the unfortunate job of being the chicken in this particular case, and the rest of the ASEAN, Southeast Asian maritime nations are the monkey, where the idea is if you let the Philippines get away with openly defying China, then you'll encourage the others to sort of be more openly defiant. And so I that may be the trap that China has kind of gotten itself into. Now, it's not much fun if you're the Philippines, because you're still sort of stuck with this thing where you've got this constant drama. But as I have argued in other places, and I will continue to argue, and I think that Greg has reinforced this today, is that, you know, the Philippines has actually gained quite a bit. It's just that, you know, the problems at the individual shoals are not resolved, or at least not well resolved in their favor. But the overall strategic situation has changed so that now they are well integrated into the U.S. Network of alliances, and they're getting a lot of benefits. And he mentioned some of the sort of moral support, but there's been also a lot of material support. I mean, Lloyd Austin was just in Manila a couple months ago, dropping off a $500 million foreign military financing package.
Right. And the other thing that Greg mentioned, which I think is also likely, is if China can show the U.S. alliance isn't worth anything, that it doesn't defend the Philippines.
That'd be a different set of monkeys, right? Which being the other U.S. allies, and that is, I mean, obviously we really hope that they don't go too far in trying to prove that point, right? Because that would put us into some scary waters, right, where we actually do have to test the limits of the alliance and the articles of the Mutual Defense Treaty that talk about armed attack.
Right. I could argue that when we didn't defend the agreement on Scarborough Shoal, that didn't only piss off the Philippines, but it called into question elsewhere our reliability.
Yeah, and as Greg mentioned, you know, almost at the same time that we were not, you know, after that, where we were not clarifying our position on Scarborough Shoal and South China and the West Philippine Sea, we were clarifying it for the Senkakus in Japan, which definitely made the Philippines feel like second-class allies.
Right. Yeah, this is a hornet's nest. I'm glad Greg's optimistic.
Yeah. Well, actually, that was encouraging.
All right. Any last words?
Well, I think it's story time, right? And I actually do have one.
Time.
It is. And so, as Greg was talking, I had a story that would have riffed off that really well. But I thought, given what we were talking about with Greg, I should really talk about 2014 in Hanoi, when I was the air attaché there, and of course the oil rig crisis erupted, and there were protests in Vietnam, large-scale protests. And by the way, if you ever spend time in a communist country, large-scale protests usually bad, right? You don't want, because sometimes they end up in very different places than you'd want them to if you are, say, a single-party state and you want to stay the single party. So, but as these things erupted, because Vietnam dealt with these in part by having an assertive transparency campaign, they actually put the videos of them getting pushed around by the Chinese ships out on YouTube. And so Vietnamese people got up in arms and there were protests. And so what the Communist Party did was they just tried to maybe organize the protests so that the protests would be properly channeled and then sort of dispersed, and that, you know, at least they'd be organized protests since they weren't protesting against the party. But as time went on, things got a little out of hand and some criminal elements got involved and the protests got a little off track and were no longer organized, and some factories were looted, and not just Chinese factories, but Taiwanese factories and Korean factories and other factories. And so at a certain point, the prime minister of Vietnam puts out 3 text messages to everyone in the country. And so I remember getting these 3 text messages on my phone. And in short, you know, what they said was, this has been fun, but this is over now. We're not doing protests anymore. And so it just so happened that I had picked that day that I was going to go out and take a look at the protests outside the Chinese embassy, just because I was an attaché, and part of what you want to do is give your sort of, you know, boots on the ground view of what's happening. So I went there. And the first place I went was the Opera House, which is where the protests were getting started. And it was during my cab ride to the Opera House where I was getting these text messages saying, oh. So as I get there, I noticed that there is nobody protesting. There is nobody gathering, but there are a lot of security people running around. So I said, huh. So apparently, at least whatever else is true, is the protests are not organizing at the Opera House today. So I get in another cab and I go over to Lenin Park. So, and no kidding, in the middle of Hanoi, there is a big statue of Vladimir Lenin, and he is standing right across the street. Lenin Park is across the street from the Chinese embassy. And this is where they would always culminate. And once again, Lenin Park on this date was completely barricaded off by these temporary barricades. There were security people just flooding the area. And so, in fact, there was a truck that was driving down the street and picking up motorbikes with this crane and putting them on the back of the truck and driving them away. And any group that would get together with more than 2 or 3 people would be kind of broken up. And so at this point, I was really kind of bemused by all of this. And so I walked up to one of these fellows, one of the security people whose job it was apparently to sit next to the barricades around Lenin Park and turn people away if they wanted to go inside. And so I went in, and using my broken Vietnamese, I said, can I go see Lenin? And he says, no. And I said, why not? And he says, he had to think about that for a second. He said, safety. And I said, I feel very safe. There's so much security here. I feel very safe. And he says, I said, safety for who? And he thought about that for a second. And he said, foreigners. And so at that point, I left the man alone because, of course, there was nothing he could do. He was going to do his job. And I was just kind of being a jerk, frankly. But that was the day the protest ended. And it was extremely effective. They just sort of flooded the zone with security, and nobody got together. And if they're not together, you don't have to break them up.
Well, I just hope you got to visit Lenin eventually.
Fortunately, he was always on my way to work. Lenin Park is actually a place where you'll see, usually on your way back and forth or on a Saturday, you see kids playing, you'll see badminton games. So it is a fairly well-used public park, and he towers over it.
Good for him.
All right. Well, Jim, this has been fun. Of course, as we wind this up, Ian Ellis Jones, of course, is our producer. He has the unenviable task of making us look good in spite of ourselves. But his day job is worth following as well. So follow him on X at Ian Ellis Jones to see his remarkable products on geopolitical and military events, not just in the South China Sea, but throughout Asia and the Pacific and the Middle East. Also, of course, if you've enjoyed today's episode, please come back. Join us again for our next one. Better yet, go and subscribe to us on your favorite streaming service or on YouTube, which, as I mentioned last time, we are rapidly approaching 100,000 views. Wherever you're hearing our voices, we look forward to seeing you again. And that's it for this time. So let's talk again soon on Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.